You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 3rd of July 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand.
Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One with me, Ted Kravitz. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, we discuss the new Human Rights Watch report on Syria, which claims to have uncovered a state policy of torture. We'll be exploring why European plane maker Airbus is set to open a factory in Boeing's backyard and what that will mean to the city of Mobile, Alabama. And we're in Yemen to hear an eyewitness report from journalist Casey Coombs on the aftermath of the US and Yemeni shelling of the Al-Qaeda-held Abyan region.
The war that went on in Zanzibar was completely leveled the city. As you drive along the main street, there's not one building that was untouched by bullets and shells and airstrikes and drone strikes.
Plus, we're joined by photographer Giles Price on his new exhibition showcasing the London Olympic Park as seen from a helicopter 500 feet in the air. And 50 years after she first slipped on her evening gown, Cindy the fashion doll is seeking a new owner to boost sales. All that, plus we play a classic Midori House session, all to come in the next hour here on Monocle 24. But first, it's time to catch up on the latest world news with James Luckhurst.
Monocle 24 News. There are reports that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said he regrets 100% that a Turkish jet was shot down after entering Syrian airspace last month. In an interview with a Turkish newspaper, Mr. Assad explained that the plane was flying in an area previously used by Israel's Air Force. The two pilots have not been found. Tensions have mounted along the border between Syria and Turkey, and it has become clear that the Turkish Air Force scrambled fighter jets on Monday for the third day in a row after Syrian helicopters were said to have approached the border. In other developments, the chief of the United Nations Supervision Mission in Syria has told reporters in Damascus that the search for a solution to the crisis continues following the weekend's inconclusive meeting of world powers in Geneva.
Working hard to plan on what steps to take next and meeting with the different stakeholders to find the best way forward.
In the UK, Barclays has admitted there are a few obvious candidates who would be able to restore the bank's tarnished image after the departure of Chief Executive Bob Diamond. With Chairman Marcus Aghias also due to leave following Barclays' record-breaking fine for attempting to manipulate interbank lending rates, the bank has to fill its top two roles. Analysts say potential replacements with Diamond's tough business acumen and the ability to repair the image are few and far between. The Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev has visited a remote island chain seized from Japan by the Soviet Union at the end of World War II, prompting protests from Tokyo, which lays claim to them. Mr. Medvedev's trip to the disputed islands in Russia's Far East saw Japan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs summon Russia's envoy to complain. A bomb in a small truck has exploded in a market in the Iraqi city of Diwaniya, killing 40 people. The bombing was near a Shiite mosque where pilgrims gather on their way to Kerbala to celebrate the birthday of one of the most important imams, al-Mahdi, this week. Another bomb blast has killed four more people near the city of Kerbala, the latest in a series of sectarian attacks. Police have raided the home and offices of former French President Nicolas Sarkozy as part of a judicial inquiry into financial relations between his political camp and the L'Oréal heiress Liliane Bettencourt. Mr. Sarkozy's lawyer Thierry Herzog said the raids, a day after his client had left for Canada on holiday, would show nothing and that he had already supplied information to investigators that debunked suspicions of secret meetings with Bettencourt. Mr. Sarkozy enjoyed immunity from judicial pursuit while in office, but that cover expired in mid-June. And researchers at Munich's Ludwig Maximilians University have unearthed an up-to-now unknown copy of a centuries-old map segment with the word America on it, something they've described as unique. The so-called globe segment maps by Martin Waldseemüller divided the world into 12 pointed parts intended to shape a globe. Waldseemüller was a well-known cartographer from the southern German town of Freiburg, according to Munich University, who was born around 1470 and died in 1522. His map is considered the birth certificate of America because the newly discovered continent was first mentioned here under the term America. And that's the news here at Monocle 24.
Thank you very much, James. Exactly 5 minutes past the hour, you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24.
Londonból, ez a Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
De Londres, ez a Monocle 24.
De Londres, este es Monocle 24.
London kala, Monocle 24 des.
De Londres, esse é a Monocle 24.
Londonist, sino Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λόντος, τέμα ον, Monocle 24.
Λόντζαδαν, βουρσε, Monocle 24.
Λόντον καρά, Monocle 24.
Now to our lead story on Midori House. According to a new report issued today by the New York-based Human Rights Watch, the Syrian government has been carrying out a state policy of torture as part of an effort to crush dissent throughout the current fighting in that country. The report is titled The Torture Archipelago, a nod to Alexander Solzhenitsyn's novel The Gulag Archipelago, and reveals the existence of 27 detention centres it says are being used for systemic torture across Syria. Well, joining us on the line to discuss the report further is Ole Solvang, one of the report's authors. Hello, Ole.
Hello.
Now, tell us, what is the most shocking finding of your report amongst what must be a fairly distasteful report to have to put together?
Well, you know, the issue of torture is not new in Syria. We've documented and reported on the use of torture in you know, both before the anti-government uprising and particularly after, of course. And what we're really trying to do with the report today is to put the focus on the perpetrators, and we've identified, as you said, 27 detention facilities. I mean, to me, what is really shocking is the extent of it. I've been documenting human rights violations in several countries for several years, and I'm actually finding it hard to think of a comparable situation that I worked on, both in terms of the numbers of people who have been detained and tortured. Nobody knows exactly how many, but we're talking about tens of thousands of people. But also in terms of the torture methods used, how systematic it is and how planned it is. And to be frank, it's quite shocking.
Indeed. And how did you get this information?
Well, we have the way that we usually document violations is by conducting long and detailed interviews with victims of various human rights violations. So this report is based on more than 200 interviews with former detainees, but also with defectors from the army and intelligence agencies. And when we've interviewed these people, we didn't only ask them about the torture. We also asked them about the layout of the floors, the layout of the cells, how big were the cells, how many cells on each floor. And also we asked them to identify the exact building where they were being held on set imagery. And by corroborating these interviews, by comparing them, we were able to verify much of the information. So the 27 detention facilities that we have listed in the report are those for which multiple witnesses indicated the same location and described the same type of torture.
Indeed. And these detention centres, perhaps what's equally disturbing is that they are spread out through major cities and the length of Syria, from Aleppo to Homs and further.
Absolutely. I mean, these detention facilities form a network all over Syria, and commonly, you know, somebody would be picked up in detained in a small town. He would then be transferred to the detention facility in the bigger town, spending there a couple of days during which he would be tortured, and then being sent further on until he ends up in one of the big detention facilities in Damascus or in Idlib, Daraa, or some of the other big cities. And sometimes these detainees spend weeks and months in these detention facilities and without any kind of formal procedure or without ever being presented to a judge.
Yes, and we hear in the news President Bashar al-Assad has spoken of the downing of a Turkish plane on the Syrian border, and your report today will only add to the increased pressure. Do you expect much traction from your report, much to be done, if anything, as a result of your report?
I mean, what we're calling for is the international community has been very much focused on Kofi Annan's peace plan, the ceasefire agreement, the need for political dialogue, and perhaps rightly so. But all of these efforts have been geared towards, in one way, treating the symptoms. Because at the core of the crisis in Syria, the conflict is about the human rights violations. If you remember, it started when the authorities detained and tortured a group of children in the southern city of Daraa. That was a spark for the whole uprising in Syria. And I think there is a real need for a unified international response or pressure on the Syrian government to end these abuses. So what we're calling on is for the United Nations Security Council to adopt targeted sanctions against officials and officers implicated in this abuse and to refer the situation to the International Criminal Court in The Hague, which is the appropriate venue for investigating crimes against humanity, which is taking place in Syria today.
And presumably it's your hope as well that your exposure of the widespread torture in Syria will lead to some of the nations that have been defending Syria to reconsider their position.
Well, of course, the United Nations Security Council has been, to some extent, held hostage by Russia's position on Syria. Russia has blocked any kind of strong Security Council action vis-a-vis Syria. We've seen Russia shift its position slightly in the last couple of months. They supported a resolution on the Kofi Annan plan. They supported a resolution condemning a massacre in the town of Hula. But so what we really hope, and you know, we're making a major push to get this report also to the Russian public, to Russian politicians, is by publishing verified, carefully corroborated, verified facts to also be able to convince the Russian government about the realities on the ground that there are crimes against humanity being committed, and that ensuring accountability for these crimes will have to be part of finding a solution to the crisis in Syria.
Okay, well, we'll see what happens there. Follow that story closely. Thank you very much for joining us there. That's Ole Solvang, a writer of the Human Rights Watch report on the Syrian torture centres. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up next, we'll be crossing to hear from a journalist in Yemen. Stay with us.
Thailand is the world's largest exporter of rice, shipping more grains abroad than any other nation. Perhaps even more surprisingly, we're also the world's leading producer of hard disk drives, powering global electronics. And we also make great music. So from sound bites to megabytes, you could say that we're making all the right noises. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
You're listening to Midori House with Ted Kravitz. Now, as NATO forces head into their last 2 years of operations against the Taliban and al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, an equally intense but very differently fought war is being waged against al-Qaeda in Yemen. For the last year, much of the Abyan region has been held and run by Ansar al-Sharia, the local front for al-Qaeda. Backed by intensive drone strikes and with the help of the US military advisers, the Yemeni army last week retook the town of Jar, then Zinjibar and then Shakra, devastating the area but leaving the al-Qaeda militants just to head to the hills to return who knows when. Well, just before we came on air, I was joined on the line by journalist Casey Coombs from the Yemeni capital Sana'a. Casey has reported from in and around Yemen for the past year, and I started by asking what he'd found on his most recent trip to the Abyan region.
Yeah, so yesterday I traveled to the province of Abyan, which has been controlled by an al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula group called Ansar al-Sharia. They've been seeking to establish Sharia law in this province for over a year, starting early last spring when the Yemeni revolution picked up. And they have recently been dislodged from the province by U.S.-backed military forces. So yesterday I traveled with a Yemeni intelligence officer who led me and another Western colleague through two of the main strongholds that the Al-Qaeda group had held last year. And we just assessed the damage to the cities because there was pretty intense war to retake the province last year. And what we found in Zanzibar province, which is where most of the fighting took place, I mean, it was just completely obliterated. It was just really a city of rubble. There was only one restaurant that had reopened, and then there was a small cotton market, which is this green leaf stimulant that many Yemenis chew in the country. Those two centers are really the only signs of life in Zanzibar. The jar was a little different story. That is kind of the seat, the administrative seat of the Al-Qaeda government last year. They still are providing water, access to water to the population, still electricity infrastructure in place. So they still have some of these essential public services that keep the city running. So it's much more lively and very much still intact in Jar. But one very significant part of that trip was when I was interviewing a group of civilians on the outskirts of the city, and I had reported from the city a couple of months ago, back in March, and that was while it was still under the control of these Al-Qaeda militants. And as I was interviewing yesterday these civilians about life under Al-Qaeda, life after Al-Qaeda, one of the leaders who led me around in March drove up on a motorcycle and glanced down to see what was going on, and he met eye contact with me and nodded and then just drove into the city. It illustrates the huge task ahead of the U.S. and Yemeni forces getting all of the Al-Qaeda militants out of the cities, because they essentially just blend into civilian populations.
Indeed, Casey, I mean, especially when one of the Al-Qaeda soldiers can just come up to you and say hello, he recognizes you, you recognize him, and did the people you were with recognize him?
No, they didn't. There was the Yemeni intelligence officer was standing just to the side of him, and then we had a convoy of military soldiers they're all armed with Kalashnikovs, and there to provide security, and this Al-Qaeda intelligence was right under their nose, and they didn't seem to notice at all.
Mm. In your visits around, did you get the idea that the shelling was or was not exactly target-focused?
Well, as for the U.S. drones, we asked a lot of policemen and Yemeni military soldiers and local tribesmen who had taken up arms to retake the cities. We asked them about the accuracy of the U.S. drone strikes. Many of them they assessed it pretty positively, saying that, I mean, the strikes were really decisive in helping them retake these cities. But the civilians were a little bit more, not quite so enthusiastic about the drone strikes. Some of them said they had destroyed buildings. But I would say the war that went on in Zanzibar was, I mean, it was just completely leveled the city. As you drive along the main street, there's not one building that was untouched by bullets and shells and airstrikes and drone strikes and naval strikes. It was really just, it appears the building needs to be just rebuilt from the ground up.
Indeed. And Casey, just finally, because we're slightly losing the line to you, was it your sort of conclusions, if any, that actually this is proving to the civilians that something positive is being done, or is it actually doing the opposite? It's driving the civilians away and any support that might have had with the civilians of these areas?
Well, I mean, it's a pretty grim picture on the ground right now. Jar looked like it provided some hope because it was still largely intact after the war. It wasn't hit as hard as Zanzibar, but, I mean, there are thousands, hundreds of thousands of civilians returning to these cities, and they're returning to blown-up homes and no public services in some cases. It appears like it's going to be quite a while before civilians can go back and start living the lives that they did.
And that was Casey Coombs talking to me a little earlier. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24. Now, today, the appeal trial of 13 Bahrain opposition activists against their life in prison sentences resumes. The activists, who led a mass pro-democracy protest in 2011, were sentenced by a military court for plotting to overthrow the Bahraini royal family and won a retrial on April the 30th. Among them is the prominent human rights activist Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja, who ended his 110-day hunger strike against imprisonment on May the 28th. He's become a symbol of Bahrain's opposition movement and gained widespread international attention. Despite international condemnation, the Bahraini government is maintaining its position, a hardline position too, so what are the prospects for the prisoners? A little earlier, Monocle's Dominic Reynolds and Christian Yeo spoke with Mariam Al-Khawaja, acting director of the Bahrain Centre for Human Rights, and the daughter of the hunger strike and the ex-hunger striker Abdulhadi Al-Khawaja. This is what they said.
I spoke to my father last week and asked him what he thinks is going on with the trial. And he already outlined this also in his testimony to court. And he basically told me that he thinks they're being used as part of the negotiations between the government and the opposition. And his analysis is that probably what will happen is with the end of this show trial, they will probably reduce the prison sentences that they've already given them in an attempt to say that the judicial system works in Bahrain, which it doesn't, of course, because it is not independent nor fair. And then after that, they will only be released if they reach a political solution with the opposition.
Of course, whilst this is going on with these appeals or these retrials, you get the feeling we're fighting a tide here, a rising tide, or going against the flow of the river. We've got more people being convicted and jailed for up to 5 years. Some medical professionals who were found guilty of simply treating opposition activists in hospital.
One thing that we've seen as human rights defenders in Bahrain is that the very same violations that we've been documenting for over a year now are continuing to happen, and in some cases they're getting worse. For example, the kind of violence, excessive use of force that is used by the security forces in Bahrain has actually increased rather than decreased since the release of the Bahrain Independent Commission of Inquiry. And unfortunately, you know, we keep hearing internationally that Bahrain is on the path of to reform. You know, that's what they say in the UK, that's what they say in the United States. What we've seen is that since the 1920s, the Bahraini regime has actually been on a path of getting worse rather than getting better. I mean, the crackdown that we've seen in the past year is one of the worst. Since the 1920s, there's been some sort of uprising every 10 years.
Mariam, can you tell us anything about the latest protests that we saw on Sunday? And I understand the leader of one of the opposition groups, El Wafaq, was hit by a rubber bullet shot by the forces there.
We've seen definitely an escalation of attacks on prominent people in Bahrain. So at a time, for example, where they would not arrest someone like Nabil Rajab, the president of the center, he's been arrested twice and put in prison for 3 weeks at a time. Sheikh Ali Salman, who's the head of Al Wafaq, the biggest opposition society in Bahrain, was in a protest and they were shot at close range. And there's a video showing this attack. And the man who protected him was actually shot in the head and suffered from a skull fracture.
Mariam, you alluded just then to the fact that in the US and the UK, certainly, the narrative that's been thrown out from the government about Bahrain is that it's on a positive upward trend. Things are improving there. And the PR has been very much behind managed change, I suppose. What's your sense of where your international allies are?
One of the best examples is using what happens at the Human Rights Council of the United Nations. So what we saw last week was around, I think it was 28 countries come out and condemn the continued human rights violations in Bahrain and how the Bahraini government was not implementing their own recommendations the way they had said they would. And unfortunately, the United States and the United Kingdom refused to sign on to that statement. And I think, you know, this says a lot about the double standards that they're willing to put up with and not condemn the human rights violations that continue to take place in their ally country, Bahrain.
There is another side to the way the Bahraini government is putting out information to the rest of the world. I mean, three policemen are on trial for the murder of three protesters. How do you view that trial? Do you see that as sacrificial lambs to international PR, these three?
Well, I think there's several aspects to look at this, right? First of all, are these police officers actually being arrested and not allowed to be on duty and put in court? So far, as far as we know, none of them have actually been arrested. They're being put on trial, but they're not even arrested despite having torture accusations against them. Second of all, these officers are mostly from the lowest ranks in the police. Usually, they're not even Bahraini. They're people who are politically naturalized and employed in the Bahraini security forces, are as the majority of the Bahraini security forces in Bahrain. And the third thing is, when you look at accountability on a wider range, they are using these low-ranked police officers as scapegoats to get international recognition for them putting people on trial. The fact of the matter remains that the head of the Ministry of Interior and the National Security Apparatus and other places who are responsible for a lot of these crimes that happened over the past year are either in the same position they were in last year or have been promoted in some cases or are even in the commission which is supposed to implement the recommendations to solve the problems of last year. If they were part of the problem, they cannot be part of the solution now.
And that was Mariam Al-Khawaja, Acting Director of the Bahrain Centre for Human Rights, talking to Dom Reynolds and Christian Yeo a little earlier. You're listening to Midori House. It's 26 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Now we have a Monocle 24 Midori House session. This is Hanson and Mbop.
Gone so fast, oh yeah, and they're gone so fast, yeah, yeah. Oh, so don't the ones who really care. In the end, they'll be the only ones there. And when you get old, still is in your hair. Can you tell me who is still care? Yeah, can you tell me who is still care?
Apology at the end was for. That was Mbop by Hanson, performed here at Midori House a few short months ago. The time is 18:29, just approaching 18:30 here in London. Still to come in the next half hour of Midori House, we'll be joined by the photographer of a new exhibition showcasing aerial photographs of London's Olympic Park, and we'll be discussing Airbus's new move to manufacture airplanes on American soil. But first, here's James Luckhurst with the news headlines.
There are reports that Syrian President Bashar al-Assad has said he regrets 100% that a Turkish jet was shot down after entering Syrian airspace last month. In an interview with a Turkish newspaper, Mr. Assad explained that the plane was flying in an area previously used by Israel's Air Force. The two pilots of the plane have not been found. In the UK, Barclays has admitted that there are a few obvious candidates who would be able to restore the bank's tarnished image after the departure of Chief Executive Bob Diamond. With Chairman Marcus Aggias also due to leave following Barclays' record-breaking fine for attempting to manipulate interbank lending rates, the bank has to fill its two top roles. The Russian Prime Minister, Dmitry Medvedev, has visited a remote island chain seized from Japan by the Soviet Union at the end of World War II, prompting protests from Tokyo, which lays claim to them. Mr. Medvedev's trip to the disputed islands in Russia's Far East saw Japan's Ministry of Foreign Affairs summon Russia's envoy to complain. A bomb in a small truck has exploded in a market in the Iraqi city of Diwanaiya, killing 40 people. The bombing was near a Shiite mosque where pilgrims gather on their way to Karbala to celebrate the birthday of one of the most important imams, al-Mahdi, this week. And police have raided the home and offices of a former French president, Nicolas Sarkozy, as part of a judicial inquiry into financial relations between his political camp and the L'Oréal heiress Liliane Bettencourt. Mr. Sarkozy's lawyer, Thierry Herzog, said the raids, a day after his client had left for Canada on holiday, would show nothing and that he had already supplied information to investigators that debunked suspicions of secret meetings with Bettencourt. Those are the headlines here at Monocle 24.
James, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House with Ted Kravitz. Now, as European companies go, Airbus Industrie is pretty proud of its identity. Planes are made at 16 sites across four European countries, from Toulouse and Hamburg to Bristol and Seville. Airbus is proudly European. Now, while this has guaranteed aircraft sales to EU airlines, keen to show their support to their national manufacturing history industries, at the same time, it's acted as a barrier sometimes to some more proudly US airlines keen to buy American. But this week, there are no more excuses, as Airbus confirmed that after years of feasibility planning, they will be opening a production line for their A320 range in America's Deep South, Mobile, Alabama, creating over 1,000 jobs and removing one advantage that arch-rival Boeing had over its French opponent. Well, to find out how the Europeans will be welcomed in Mobile, we're joined now by Monocle's Alistair G. Hi, Alistair.
Hi there, good morning.
Now, tell us about why Airbus have moved to Mobile. It's many reasons, starting off with labour costs.
Yeah, I mean, you know, labour costs are lower in Alabama, the work rules are more flexible, but also, as you pointed out, you know, Airbus has 53% of the global market for narrow-body airliners, but it only has around 20% in the US, and that's largely, I think, because U.S. airlines maybe feel sort of a certain pressure to buy Boeing because they're produced on U.S. soil. So I think that Airbus is hoping that by moving to Mobile, it's going to eliminate that patriotic advantage that maybe Boeing has. And I think it's worth emphasizing that this narrow-body market is a huge market. I mean, Boeing estimates that around 23,000 of them narrow-body airliners are going to be built here for the next 20 years. So Airbus really has its eye on the future and on future big orders from U.S. airlines.
That's interesting, because both Boeing and Airbus are going after, as you say, this big new market. And with new, more fuel-efficient aircraft, Boeing is coming in with the 737 MAX, whereas Airbus is countering it with the A320neo, all these little suffixes and appendages to their aircraft titles, making them sound rather swish. But do aircraft operators, do the airlines, really care where their airplane is made?
I mean, I think there are certainly pressures felt. I mean, I could give you an example from the world of aerial refueling, for example. I mean, you know, there was a lot of pressure when the U.S. military was making an order, it started around a decade ago, to replace its aerial tankers, that, you know, it should be ordering Boeing. I mean, Airbus had made a bid for the deal through a U.S. subsidiary, and it even won one sort of round of the competition, but then Boeing complained that Airbus subsequently took that deal. So, you know, I do think there is a, you know, more so than in Europe, there is a strong sense here that companies should be seen to be supporting the local economy.
Well, let's talk about the local economy, and let's talk about Mobile, Alabama. What kind of place is it?
Well, I mean, actually, all of Alabama, not just Mobile, has become this rather sort of curious technology hub. I mean, Alabama has a long history of attracting technology firms. After the Second World War, the Nazi rocket scientist Wernher von Braun, he actually ended up in Huntsville, Alabama, in the north of the state, because the U.S. military, you know, he'd surrendered to the U.S. military, and the military eventually took him there, and that's where the Apollo space program was largely developed. So although you wouldn't expect it, you think space, you think maybe Florida, Texas, it's actually Alabama where a lot of the technology was developed. And now Alabama is this sort of global hub for missile and space flight technology. There are major players there like Lockheed and Northrop Grumman, as well as a host of smaller startups. And just to the town of Huntsville, for example, there's now over $100 billion in federal funding flowing every year. So, you know, Alabama, strangely enough, is this technology success story. There's also another aspect to that, and maybe it's one reason why Airbus is choosing Alabama over adding more factories in China. It currently produces something to be 20 there, and that is that wages and benefits in China are now increasing by 15 to 20% per year. So manufacturing there is all of a sudden a much less attractive proposition. So we're actually seeing a lot of onshoring as opposed to offshoring, companies moving back to Alabama and also to all across the states, because all of a sudden it's now more expensive to manufacture in places like China, all these places that traditionally have been these, you know, new manufacturing hotspots.
Indeed, and there's obviously expertise in Alabama, in Huntsville and in Mobile. Mm-hmm. Is there, though, any truth to the suggestions that actually there are less unionized workers in Alabama than, say, on Boeing's backyard in Washington State, and therefore it's more attractive for Airbus to make planes there?
I'm not an expert in that, so I couldn't tell you, but I do know that generally it is easier to hire and fire people in Alabama than many places in the state.
That's interesting. Why is that, do you think? Just state law?
No, I'm not an expert in this, but this is just something that people have told me when I've been reporting there. But I couldn't tell you much more about it.
Yeah, well, I'm just looking through your article for Monocle a few issues ago on Huntsville. And, I mean, it looks not only that it's a good place to do business, to manufacture, but a nice place to live as well.
Yeah, I mean, Huntsville is really charming. I mean, it has this gorgeous gorgeous little downtown filled with Civil War era antebellum houses and, you know, sort of quaint little cafes and, you know, as well as that very sort of cutesy downtown. It also has this, you know, these incredible technology parks sort of filled with these gleaming glass buildings. You know, it's home to this major army base which receives, you know, tens of billions of dollars a year, and it's essentially a federal office park is how it's described, filled also with, you know, lots of sort of very high-tech office buildings, the kind of thing that you would expect to find in Silicon Valley and not Alabama. It's attracting from Silicon Valley professionals. You know, I sort of went to a biotech campus there, and, you know, the head of genetics there was formerly the head of genetics at Stanford University. So, you know, strangely enough, it is proving a drawing point for science and technology professionals from across the states.
Indeed, and soon to be joined by the French and Germans heading up Airbus USA. Okay, thanks very much for joining us, Alistair. That's Monocle's Alistair G. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be joined in the studio in a moment by photographer Giles Price in just a second.
Thailand's famous hospitality is ingrained in our culture. From the warmest of welcomes to our culinary skill. That's why hospitality businesses like the world's best cooking school, Le Cordon Bleu, come to Thailand to sample our unique mix of exquisite cuisine and transcendent service. And all this against a soundtrack of fantastic homemade music. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Antwerp Academy of Fashion has a reputation for turning out some of the most cutting-edge designers of the day. It's where rising stars are discovered and a heady place to witness the impulses of Generation Next. We travel to Antwerp to scout out students on the threshold of success.
Fashion for me, first of all, it's a research. It's a research about the human, it's research about who they are, how they think. I start really looking up for images of sleeping beautiful woman, Surprisingly, I found it in horror movies. So all the pieces are made with a red thread only. If you come closer, you will see that the blood really runs in the garment.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in our program archive on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House with Ted Kravitz. Now, we've all become used to instant access to satellite images and aerial photographs, previously limited to surveillance agencies and air forces. Now we can all download detailed photos of anywhere in the world photographed from above. But apart from showing us terrible garden furniture and the surprising number of houses with swimming pools, these photos seldom have much thought put into their content and composition. Until now, and specifically the soon-to-be-finished Olympic Park in London, which is the subject of E2012 Under Construction, a series of photographs detailing the stadiums, courts, velodromes, bridges, swimming centres, athletes' villages, and everything that goes into making this year's Summer Olympic Games happen. Well, joining us in the studio, I'm delighted to say, is Giles Price, the author, photographer of this new exhibition. Tell us, the first thing I thought, Giles, when I saw of it was this looks a lot like Andreas Gursky's work.
Well, thank you very much. That's a very flattering association to have. My interest to documenting this particular project in that way originally came about 3 years ago. LDA London, who were the London design agency, who are now defunct, ironically enough, approached me about shooting some portraits and some landscapes in Hackney Wick, which is just adjacent to the Olympic Park. And I wrote a proposal to them, being that my practice before now has been pretty much sort of portrait-based. And within the proposal of how I'd treat the landscape, my sort of fascination with sort of cartography, which comes from 20 years ago being in the military and doing a lot of mountaineering now, and my sort of fascination with Google Earth and the sort of visual language, which this has now become in the sort of the modern day with iPhones and the technology that we can interact with this stuff on, led me into this narrative of how I would document that particular project. Now, unfortunately, LDA became defunct a few years ago in the first round of the cuts, so this proposal didn't go anywhere. I then, through the process of spending more time down there, I became quite fascinated in the thing that you couldn't actually see what was happening behind this sort of fence. And there were levels of control measures about people documenting whatever capacities.
But you were allowed to go over and take these photographs, or you had to seek specific permission?
No. The airspace has been totally open. I think they've shut it now. Officially, it was meant to shut on the 14th of July.
Yeah.
There have been, especially in the last few weeks, there have been certain images which have... Which have come out through sort of press people flying around shooting construction opening ceremony. So I think that Mr. Danny Boyle and various people at Local were going, hold on a minute, we're going to end up.
Yes, they weren't. They weren't particularly pleased when people got some shots of their of their rehearsals.
No, so I've heard that it is this airspace. I think has been shut down.
Yeah,
but
for
the time that I was flying in it, no, the airspace was open for whoever chose to.
And how did you do it? It was a chartered helicopter. You had a little camera on a Westcam device or something like that.
No, chartered helicopter. Yes. Then me sat hanging out the door with a rig that I'd made, and then me strapped into the fuselage. So. Yeah, there's a physicality as well as a sort of technicality in making these images.
Certainly sounds like it. What struck you when you were looking at the images you got when you got back, and indeed when you're choosing which ones to put into the exhibition? What struck you? Some of the symmetry, some of the strange colours, some of the design. What?
Yeah, I think all of those facets became quite sort of obvious as I started to edit them. Because I started this just over 2 years ago, the site was already in a sort of construction sort of phase. So I had earlier stuff which is more barren and just sort of diggers. But as the process evolved and I started to edit within the evolution of that, actually it became the sort of tension of the two, where you've got formed structures, so beautifully designed buildings and areas, and then you've got the counter to that being the dirt and the rubble. So you have this sort of flux moment. And just the, you know, I never realised how many different colours of soil there are. And
so, well, indeed, but it was an interesting site because it was previously home, still is, to an aggregates kind of firm.
Yeah.
And it was one of the most polluted sites in the whole of London.
Yeah.
They had to wash soil.
The Belgians. The Belgians are the masters or the world leaders in washing soil, as I found out when I got access to the site. Yeah.
Right. And what about the buildings themselves? Because places like the Velodrome, very beautiful, you know, they've a lot of the other places have been, you know, designed. Zaha Hadid has actually designed some of the places. But from above, they take on a very different form.
Yes. I mean, I have to admit that I am no sort of connoisseur in architecture. For me, it was really just pure shape and form of taking that vertical sort of position in my process. And that's all I was looking at it on. So in a way, maybe that helped me in that I was not necessarily so necessarily precious of showing some of these shapes and forms maybe in their sort of purity. For me, it literally was just, well, that looks visually interesting from that angle. If I've lost half the building, then so what?
But that's possibly a good thing, because the aquatic centre, the sewing centre, which has been designed by Zaha Hadid, a lot of people think it looks like a sort of concrete processing plant.
Yeah, I think, I mean, personally, that and the Velodrome are beautiful buildings. I think from my understanding and the various people that I've met along the way and heard speak, they are the two sort of more permanent sort of legacy buildings on the site. And I think that especially with the Aquatic Centre, once it's lost its wings, only then will it actually take on its pure sort of shape and form and sort of, you know, presence within that landscape.
No, indeed. It's got these huge seating areas, yeah, which will be cut down to a smaller capacity after the Games. Tell me, what about some of the bridges, the waterways, and what struck me also was the colours of some of the courts, the volleyball courts, the tennis courts. I wasn't expecting them to be pink and bright blue.
Ah, nor was I. And I've only found out being that actually one of my, one of the guys who was overseeing the printing for me is actually an avid hockey fan. And he told me actually it's to do with, it's a bit like sort of green screen. It's to do with the ball rendering itself within sort of HD televised coverage. So I think that's why you've got these really vivid sort of colours on the courts, is to sort of, yeah, maximise the coverage and the probably balls crossing lines and people objecting to them in the moments. But anyway.
Yeah, well, indeed, there will be Wimbledon. Tennis will be at Wimbledon as well. And tell us just more broadly, are you going to some of the games? London here, from where we're speaking of, seems to be gearing up. Olympic rings are starting to be painted on street lanes, to be dedicated Olympic lanes.
It's all radically taking shape as we speak, yeah. I don't know. We've been having a dialogue with actually Kevin Owens, who's the design principal for LOCOG, who's seen the project, about potentially trying to carry it on and document the games in a similar sort of way while it's happening. Like with all these things, there's long chains of command and there's, you know, various different aspects to it. So I don't know. That's potentially may happen or may not. Apart from that, no, I don't actually have any tickets on that side of things.
Well, join the club. You're amongst many Londoners who don't, but certainly an interesting period approaching for the Olympic Games in London. Listen, that's all we've got time for, but thank you very much.
Thank you for your
time.
For
coming in. Oh, just remind us where the exhibition is.
Exhibition is on in The Crossing, which is in the new Central St Martin's building in King's Cross.
Ah, King's Cross, right. Yep, I know it well. Just around the corner from me. Thank you very much, Giles Price, and you can watch and see those exhibits, as we just heard, in the new Central St Martin's building, just up the road from King's Cross Station. You're listening to Midori House.
You've been pulling, you've been winching, you've been hauling. poison, but my legs are made of lead.
And that was Apple Pie Bed by Lawrence Arabia. Now, for many kids growing up in the 60s, 70s and 80s, the bright pink fashion doll was the must-have play item. And the British Cindy was the wholesome, tasteful cousin of the more brash, decidedly pinker Barbie. Indeed, some have complained that Cindy was starting to look a bit like Barbie in recent years, but the traditional doll, the original English Rose, created in 1963, will now have a brand relaunch after Pedigree Toys announced plans for a major celebration of Cindy's 50th birthday. Well, for more on this, we're joined by Anna Jalili on the line, a Cindy lover herself and co-founder of the website Our Cindy Museum. Hi, Anna.
Hello.
Now, tell us a bit about Cindy's history. Is it fair to say that Cindy was the slightly more English, more wholesome version of Barbie? Is that fair?
I think that's very fair. Cindy was, as you rightly say, introduced in 1963. She was designed to be the girl next door. She had a sensible size 10 figure. And really, she was supposed to reflect the aspirations of little British girls at the time. And as you've rightly pointed out, she was the cherished doll of many girls through the 60s, the 70s and the 80s. In about 1986, Pedigree gave the license to Hasbro, who created their own doll. And she was a very pretty doll with a lovely face. But she began to look more and more like Barbie, and in the end she became indistinguishable from Barbie. Mm. And that's really when I think Cindy lost her way, and she stopped being a doll in her own right, you know, if you like, a different sort of choice in terms of a fashion doll. And so, sadly, she went out of production.
Any ideas or plans to reintroduce that kind of wholesome heritage?
I think that's the idea that Pedigree are going for. I think they want to return to the original doll, you know, the doll that could distinguish herself from the Barbie. They can't compete against, you know, the might of Mattel and Barbie these days. And I think there's also very much a feeling now, you know, back to basics, back to what it was that little girls treasured, and which I also think mothers, of which parents generally liked to buy for their children, something that was a little bit more wholesome, a little bit less brash, and perhaps, you know, hanging on to a little girl's childhood for a little bit longer.
And what about the fashions that Cindy Dolls used to be able to be dressed in?
Well, she had a whole range of outfits, and Cindy was a very up-to-the-minute girl in terms of her outfits. And in fact, you can actually trace British fashion from the 60s right through to the 80s just by looking at the Cindy fashions and outfits of the time. In the 60s, when she was first introduced, she wore wool dresses with little scarves, very sort of Jackie Onassis, right through to pretty little cotton nighties. And then as she moved on into the 70s, her outfits were replaced with the miniskirt. She moved on to sort of man-made fibres, maxi dresses, the gypsy dresses. And then right into the 80s, where you started to see the introduction of lycra and the whole range of sort of styles that she went through, from sort of new romantic. In the 70s, she had a lovely Bay City Rollers type outfit. So she actually followed the fashions quite closely.
Okay, well, we look forward to the rebrand. Thank you very much, and the relaunch. Thank you very much for joining us. That's Anna Jalili, co-founder of the website Art Cindy Museum. Now, finally, it seems longer, but this week marked the 15-year anniversary of the handover of Hong Kong from the British to China. Few who saw it will forget that night in Wan Chai, when royals, prime ministers and presidents stood out in the warm rain in what seemed like an endless and rather sombre ceremony. On the anniversary earlier this week, an estimated 100,000 Hong Kong residents marched through the streets to voice their protests against the current Chinese president, Hu Jintao. Monocle's Hong Kong bureau chief, Liv Lewichnik, was there to witness events and had this to say.
2 days ago, Hong Kongers took to the streets in the thousands to mark the 15th anniversary of the handover of Hong Kong to China. They also took to the streets to protest the lack of universal suffrage in Hong Kong, and to show that they're fed up with political wrangling and corruption at home, and to express their wariness of the influence seemingly being extended from the Communist Party in Beijing. In 1997, Hong Kong was handed back to China under the One Country, Two Systems rule, whereby the government in Beijing grants Hong Kong certain autonomy, such as free assembly and the right to free speech. The protesters are evidence of the freedoms that exist in Hong Kong. Such large-scale public gatherings on the mainland would be inconceivable without harsh repression. Though the protest was peaceful, with young families pushing their toddlers in prams, teenagers and middle-aged professionals holding umbrellas to shield from the sun, the mood was defiant. Hong Kongers aren't happy with the current state of affairs, and they're showing it. People are worried about rising property prices, of the widening wealth gap, and about the new chief executive, Leung Jingying, who was sworn in by the Chinese president Hu Jintao just hours before the protest took place on Sunday. A big worry is Leung's close ties to the Beijing government, as well as Beijing's influence over who gets to run Hong Kong and who doesn't. Beijing has promised direct elections for 2017, but Hong Kongers seem skeptical this will happen. What's more, Leung has in the past few days been heavily criticised for having so-called illegal structures at his home on the Peak, the most exclusive address in Hong Kong. He may now be in the process of removing the illegal basement and parking space, but more damage to his political persona has been done. He's seen as aloof. As Leung settles in to govern Hong Kong this week, he has his work cut out for himself trying to get into Hong Kongers' good books. And if the recent public outcries from the Tiananmen Square candlelit vigil on the 4th of June, which drew 200,000 protesters, including many mainlanders who had come over for the day, to the protest on 10th of June, which called for an official investigation into the suspicious death of Tiananmen Square activist Li Wangyang earlier in the month, it's not certain that the defiant mood here will abate anytime soon. For Monocle in Hong Kong, I'm Liv Lewichnik.
And that's all we've got time for this edition of Midori House. Many thanks to our producer, Dawn Trump. Our researcher was Fernando Augusto Pacheco. And our studio manager today was Alex Jakes. Up next after the news is this week's episode of our Design Bible Section D with Hugo MacDonald. In 3 hours' time at 2200 hours London time, Emma Nelson and Andrew Mullier are here with the Monocle Daily. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow. But from me, Ted Kravitz, for now, thanks very much for listening and goodbye.